From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. We lost four more marquee restaurants this week. Joseph Centeno's Baco Mercat, Ray Garcia's Broken Spanish, Jose Andres Bazaar, and Somni from Aitor Zabala. I fear that this is just the beginning of a massive transformation of our dining landscape, a heartbreaking coda to an extraordinary period of a new kind of dining experience that made the world look to Los Angeles. Joseph and Baco were the beginning, literally. His decision to open a restaurant at 4th and Main in downtown LA would be the spark that created the boom, first of a crowd of busy restaurants, and then the extraordinary amount of development that followed. As the pace of restaurant closures quickens, cities are finally getting their act together and trying to save them. Across Los Angeles, from Boyle Heights to Westchester, tables and chairs are occupying what was once a restaurant's coveted asset, parking spaces. For years, the lack of outdoor dining spaces in LA has been a mystery. How could it be that Los Angeles, with our nearly year-round sunshine and temperate weather, had so few places to eat outside? I knew firsthand how hard it was. I watched as restaurants across the street from mine put tables out on the sidewalk and nothing happened. So I did it too and got cited and told to bring the tables back inside. One of the few bright spots of this pandemic is that permitting agencies are trying to be more flexible to keep restaurants alive. Frances Anderton, host of KCRW's DNA, joins us to go deep into how one neighborhood came together to reimagine what it means to dine out. Hi, Frances.
Hello, Evan.
Set the scene for us. What did Santa Monica's Main Street look like before COVID, and what does it look like now?
Well, Santa Monica's Main Street, which, by the way, lies between Pico at the north end and almost towards Rose Avenue at the south end, it was a shopping and eating street, also a lot of nail salons, attractive to tourists. It was already feeling, I would say, a little bit depressed. Shops were already closing. Retail has taken a big hit, as we know, brick and mortar retail. COVID intensified all of that. In the early weeks of the pandemic, poor old Main Street was feeling really sad. Now, it was one of many retail streets that were feeling really sad, and the city of Santa Monica really stepped in and took action. So the city of Santa Monica instituted what they're calling a local emergency order, which basically gave businesses permission to apply for a permit to put their tables and chairs out on the sidewalks, but even also in the parking zone. And we can get to the significance of that in a minute. But what you have now is Lula's, Chinois on Main, Tsukiji Sushi Shen, Library Ale House, Pajoli, a whole bunch of eateries on Main Street have now got diners sitting in the parking lane at tables that are safely distanced from each other, and the place has totally come alive.
I think about my experience of opening the three Angeli restaurants that I opened and how fraught the issue of parking was that we had to solve before we could even get permitted. This just seems like some alternate reality that cities have gone into, that all of a sudden things that were met with just a series of absolute no's have now been met with, sure, why not?
It's completely fascinating. I mean, this is a region where, according to a mobility expert I know named John Rassant, parking took up 200 square miles of space. This is in Greater LA. Parking absolutely dominated decisions. As you said at the setup to this story, you referred to the joy of eating out when you go to restaurants in all sorts of cities around the world. And here we are in sunny LA, and we're eating in air-conditioned interiors. It's nutty. That's because the automobile has driven planning decisions to an extraordinary degree here in LA. Now, for the last 20 or so years, urban activists around safety for pedestrians and cyclists have been fighting to change this status quo. Also, people who have wanted the opportunity to see more housing built in LA have also been fighting the parking status quo because of these parking minimums attached to development that make it so difficult to build affordable housing. Then add to that, there's been a fight on behalf of street vendors to allow street vending to happen on the streets. Put together those three impetuses, you had momentum building. So then along comes COVID. Businesses are desperate. Cities are desperate. Cities need the tax revenues from the businesses. Their own livelihoods are at stake. So everybody has had to put on their thinking caps and say, we've got to do something right now. So what you have is this amazing spectacle of tables and chairs in the parking zone, barricaded, I will say, from the cars themselves that are in the next lane by these massive chunks of concrete that are called K-rails. The city, as part of its project to enable these restaurants to get back to business again, put in these £4,000 K-rails for necessary protection. They had to restripe the road to make all this work. It's brought together issues around parking and issues around eating.
So, Frances, do restaurants have freedom to make the dividers or the area, the parklets themselves, look more attractive and sort of on brand for themselves? Or is it one continuous look for everybody?
It isn't a continuous look. And I have to say that's one of the things that's really delightful about all this, because one has watched in the course of 2 weeks as restaurants have kind of been given this chunk of asphalt with some concrete blocks running alongside, and they've kind of had to quickly figure out how to make it attractive. So you find real differentiation. For example, Chien Noir on Main, you know, they tapped an events planner and they have a kind of faux hedge that goes in to sort of conceal the K-rails. They've put in plants. One place has put AstroTurf climbing up the side of the K-rail.
So I'm really intrigued by what choices Pajoli has made since they're the most recent of all of these restaurants to open, and they're very high end.
Indeed they are. And I spoke with Anne Shing. She is COO of Pajoli. And she said that when they came to think about how to make their outside area attractive, they wanted it to have the same level of, I guess, sort of design thinking that had gone into the interior. Here's what she had to say.
We obviously can't help the cars whizzing by, but, you know, we bought really large umbrellas, and our designer was very specific. He wanted square umbrellas. We laid out carpet. We bought table padding. So in that respect, we did have to pay some upfront costs, but I think hopefully in the long run, maybe Main Street and Santa Monica will let us keep the outdoor dining. And if that's the case, then we can really work on it a little bit more.
You know, this whole evolving situation and set of responses to it is so interesting because, first of all, the fact that cities like Santa Monica are trying to make changes so quickly is very uncharacteristic. And the fact that they are collaborating with people outside of city agencies in a way that seems much more fluid than they have in the past is very interesting. Do you think there is a future for this, or do you think this is just purely limited by the COVID situation?
Evan, I think you're being extremely circumspect with your choice of words. Santa Monica could be controlling to a point of mania. And I say that with affection because this city has great values in lots of ways. But one of the absolute delights of what you see on Main Street now is the sort of organic, grassroots, kind of edgy quality. I've used the word in describing it to somebody. I use the word, it almost feels kind of punk. You know, it's almost like it's the nearest Santa Monica has been to Berlin, you know, ever. There's a real feeling of how great this is. Like you said in your setup, this is one of the sort of lights of this challenging period we're in. Tables are popping up on sidewalks and in parking areas in other parts of town. The Glendale Galleria put tables and chairs in a parking structure. There's something afoot here. We're messing with the urban configuration. It's fascinating.
Well, it will be so interesting to continue to monitor what happens to our urban spaces as a result of this horror that we're living. Perhaps there could be some light at the end that will make us more of a community that can engage more freely, because we certainly are going to need it.
That's very true, Evan. On a lighter note, I will just say that people should look at The Onion, you know, which is the satirical publication, and they had a lot of fun with the idea of Angelenos having tables and chairs in the middle of the 101 freeway. It's a very funny image.
It's really hilarious. Well, thank you so much, Frances.
You are so welcome, Evan.
That was Frances Anderton, host of DNA, KCRW's show about design and architecture. Vinegary deviled eggs and boneless short ribs in all their beefy goodness. These were just a few favorites of Irene Verbilla's in her review of Post and Beam when it first opened back in 2011. The restaurant was just recognized by the Los Angeles Times with this year's Gold Award, named for Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jonathan Gold, who called Post and Beam the most ambitious restaurant to ever open in the Crenshaw District. Today, we're joined by its current chef owner, John Cleveland. Hi, John. How are you?
I am doing well, considering. I think we all are just taking it day by day. How about yourself?
I'm just really grateful to be talking to you right now. Post and Beam is such an extraordinary place, and it has so much longevity and goodwill. It was originally opened by Brad and Linda Johnson, along with Chef Govind Armstrong, in 2011 in the parking lot of the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Plaza Mall. When did you take the reins?
I came on in 2017 as a chef. Under Govind Armstrong, and my wife and I took over the reins last June 2019, and here we are. We just finished our first 12 months.
As I understand it, you and your wife were regulars at the restaurant before you actually got the keys to the place, or before you you started working there. Tell us a bit more about your background. How did you get into food?
I think we, I got into food as a kid. My grandmother was a chef. My dad and my family was a lot of cooks, caterers, and so forth. So I was always worked in restaurants. I started my first job 14 years old as a grill cook at a small cafe on the beach in North Carolina. But I've been a student and infatuated with dining and food, growing up in Oakland and in North Carolina and moving out to LA in 2012. That's been my life. I live in and breathe it.
Brad Johnson has often spoken about the Black culinary pool, how important it is to have people of color behind the stoves, and how challenging it often can be. Could you speak a bit to that? In the kitchens that you were in before, did you find yourself to often be the only Black cook?
I think I could, in the history of working in kitchens, think of a lot of times where I was the only Black cook. But there's been oftentimes, maybe not in the same kind of kitchens, where I've cooked amongst a lot of other Black cooks. We don't often get a time. It's not a lot of places you can do it like at Post and Beam, which is what I think makes it unique. I think Brad Johnson and Linda were visionary in bringing this option to the community. Having an environment, a scratch kitchen that you can grow in and learn and just really feel comfortable being yourself is something that, we strive to provide at Post and Beam. I think it's unique. I don't think if you can put it in perspective, it's not just, who you're cooking with, but geographically where we get to cook it at has a lot to do with it as well. I mean, we get to cook great food in a neighborhood that we live in. So it really does a lot of to the vibe and atmosphere.
Yeah, you're part of the community you're serving.
Correct. So, you know, I enjoy cooking in all over the place, but it's a special feeling being able to do it right here off of Crenshaw in the neighborhood.
I always loved eating there. You know, whenever I would walk into that dining room, it always reminded me in a way of my place in the relationship of regulars to the staff, how comfortable everybody is with everyone, and how lively and positive a place it's always been.
Yeah, it's got that like cozy feel to it. I remember one of our regulars used to tell me one day that one of the things that she just would enjoy watching, she would come every couple of days for happy hour. And during that time, it's like a shift change. And we got, you know, people coming in and out, and to watch our staff members hug each other as they depart in the middle of shift changes. And some of the regulars are there. They also come and enjoy. They hug the staff. To not have that anymore feels so weird.
I know. It's awful. I miss hugging so much.
It's so weird to not hug people. I haven't hugged people in so long.
So let's talk about the Gold Award. It's given annually, quote, with the idea of honoring culinary excellence and expanding the notion of what Southern California cooking can be, unquote. You and your wife, Ronnie, who's also involved in the business, have a young son. Can you talk to us about teaching him the commitment and significance of having a business in South LA?
I hope he's just soaking it all in. I think we're in such a wonderful position to learn what it means at a time where it means a lot. You know, we've gone from a more fine dining oriented, fine casual type atmosphere, celebratory food, to now we get to cook for people that really need food. I make free food. I've sold $5 plates of food, $10 plates of food. So everything's always going to be one way as a business owner, especially in South LA. Right now, my son is being taught the rigorous task of learning how to make pizza from scratch. So he makes a pizza every day.
That's wonderful.
You take baby steps into the process of being an entrepreneur.
For someone who has never eaten at Post and Beam before, what do you think they should try the first time they go online to order from you?
I always tell people whatever jumps off the page is what you should go with, because it's all good. But I have to say our most popular dishes are catfish, always has been for the past couple of years.
That's what blew me away the last time I ate there. I loved it so much.
It's a winner. One of our standard favorites, though, I have to say, is the Angus beef short rib. It's a braised short rib that is just so, so tender.
Well, thank you so much. It's lovely to meet you.
Thanks for catching up, Evan.
That's Chef John Cleveland of Post and Beam. The restaurant will be participating in Black Restaurant Week, which kicks off Friday, August 7th and runs through August 16th. Its prefix menu will include a build-it-yourself personal pan pizza, Angus short ribs with a side, and for dessert, a slice of classic pound cake. Coming up, Bristol Bay, Alaska is home to the last untouched salmon run on Earth. A new documentary gives us a front row seat to the pristine waterways of the region and the urgent fight to preserve them. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Sometimes I'm just at a loss. As we lose more and more wild spaces to man's overarching footprint, it seems that some animals and places should remain untouched, if only to remind ourselves of where we came from and the sheer wonder of life on Earth. The last fully intact salmon-run ecosystem left on Earth is threatened by a proposed copper mine. Again, Mark Titus documented the struggle in Bristol Bay in his film, The Wild. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Evan.
So we've been here before. I thought that the Pebble Mine at Bristol Bay was denied. What happened?
That's what everybody thought, including my own family and friends. And for a while, that was the case. Under the Obama administration, his EPA conducted a 3-year scientific watershed assessment of the region. And after that 3-year period, determined that a mine the size and scope of the proposed Pebble Mine and a completely wet and interconnected ecosystem like Bristol Bay and its dependent people and fisheries could not exist together. That all changed abruptly with a new Trump administration in 2016.
So who was the official who actually said, okay, that denial is revoked? It's now open again.
Well, as these things tend to be, it's complicated. It was in stages, but what really transpired was a meeting between the Pebble CEO, Tom Collier, and the then head of the EPA. They had a closed-door meeting, and lo and behold, 1 hour later, the EPA was then instructed to stand down on those protections. Since that moment, that closed-door meeting, this project has been fast-tracked through a reckless EIS or environmental impact statement, and it has now been dropped just on July 26th, the final EIS. And we're now awaiting a permit, which almost certainly is going to be in the positive for the Pebble Mine within the summertime here, for sure.
Okay, now this is a battle that involves so many different things. It involves culture, food, economics, and ecology. Let's take a look at each part. First, the culture. Where is Bristol Bay, and what is the relationship between the salmon and the indigenous who live there?
Bristol Bay, if you look at a map of Alaska, there's a kind of a craw where the Aleutian chain comes and meets the main part of Alaska. And this is south of Anchorage by about 400 miles. And it is in the center, Bristol Bay is in the center of a really incredible drainage of 8 major river systems that are all completely flush with salmon and have been for the last 10,000 years. The people that live there, the Yupik, the Aleutic, the Dena Inna people, have thrived because of this salmon system. They have seen these fish come back from time immemorial. And up to this very day, they use this food source as their primary food engine throughout the year. So we just actually saw the bulk of the run come up just this year in 2020. And once again, just like the last 6 years in a row, Bristol Bay has seen upwards of 50 million fish return to its rivers. That means that it supports an economy that delivers 14,000 American jobs, $1.5 billion to the American economy, and most importantly, to the people who have lived there for over 4,000 years. It is a steady, perfect food source that will last them the entire year through canning, smoking, drying, freezing, and eating it fresh.
The images that you shot of the salmon in the water are extraordinary. We're talking about sockeye salmon, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There are all five species of Pacific salmon in Bristol Bay that return to its rivers. It's primarily known for sockeye. It's the largest sockeye salmon run in the world. And as a matter of fact, supplies half the world's supply of sockeye salmon.
So when we say the word bay, to a lot of people, that's like a nice area, but kind of small. Can you give us an idea of the actual size of this ecosystem?
Yeah, it's, Alaskans are fond of saying, if you cut Alaska in half, Texas would be the third largest state. Again, it's eight major river systems. We're talking about hundreds of square miles. It is unlike anything left in the lower 48, we used to have landscapes like this in the West, all over the place, in California, Oregon, Washington, up and down the coast. And the reason they were so rich and full of life is because they were intact, meaning that the riparian systems there, the river systems, hadn't been developed, hadn't been dredged or drained or dammed or exploited for the fish or another resource. They were left intact, and left behind was gravel and cold, clear water. And that's exactly what salmon need to thrive, and that's exactly what there's lots of in Bristol Bay.
It's just kind of staggering to me, this idea that it is the last fully intact salmon-run ecosystem on Earth.
Yeah. It's hard for me to contemplate this too, but fully intact means that the system hasn't been exploited, it hasn't been industrialized yet, and the reason that these salmon are so profoundly efficient and regenerative is because it hasn't been touched. There isn't anything like that left on Earth.
So let's talk about what happens to the land, to the ecology of the area with these kind of mines. Is this the kind of mine where you dig into the side of a mountain, or is this a pit?
This is a low-grade sulfur, copper, and gold, and molybdenum mine. And it is not the kind you dig into the side of a mountain. It's the kind you go down. And by down, I mean like as deep as the Grand Canyon down to get to the full resource. The reason you got to dig so much, and the reason this thing could be so toxic, is because of the amount of material that you have to pull out. 11 billion tons of material and an effluent that has to be stored and maintained forever behind an earthen dam that is the size of the Space Needle here in Seattle. So think about that. That's like 800 foot tall earthen embankment that's got to hold back this vast amount of toxic material in perpetuity, in an earthquake zone.
So you're digging a pit in that deep in an area where the water table is extremely high. I mean, the water is almost on the surface throughout this whole area.
The reason sockeye salmon thrive here is because of that. The vast glaciers that retreated from this area left behind them this strata of gravel and lakes. As it retreated, it left these vast amount of lakes, big lakes, and lakes all over the place, which are connected by these major rivers. And that's exactly what sockeye salmon need to thrive. They need this clean, cold waterways that go through lakes and up into upper tributaries, which is where the salmon go to spawn. And that's precisely where this mine would be dug. But to go one step further on this, with the interconnection of this, by everything being connected by water, it really is about a death by a thousand cuts, like I've seen here in my part of the world. There's no industrialization currently in this part of Bristol Bay. So everything would have to be built. And that means roads, at least 88 miles of roads. It would have to have a deep water port. It would have to have pipelines. It would have to have culverts. It would have to have a power plant and all kinds of effluent, including fuel and remains from this mine, would have to be trucked, transported, and shipped all around through this pristine wilderness.
One of the things that I find so interesting is that the company, and you always hear this from these companies, always say that this is about jobs, that mm-hmm. people should be thrilled that this opportunity is coming because it delivers jobs. But there are already jobs there. There already is a huge industry there.
Look, you have to look at this in a way about what is the risk worth? Because you're right. There are currently 14,000 plus steady jobs just associated with the commercial fishery. That's not even including the sport fishery. So for fly fishermen and women and folks that are tourists looking at the bears and the wilderness that exists there, that's a whole nother category. But 14,000 commercial fishing jobs, $1.5 plus billion to the American economy versus a potential, if the entire resource from the mine were exploited, it would last for 100 years. And it would provide up to 850 jobs. And those jobs would be well-paying. But it is unclear at best and unlikely at realistically at worst that the locals would be receiving those high-paying jobs. The most important thing, though, is what happens when that life of that mine has exhausted itself and there are no more jobs, there is no more income from that, and this mess that's left behind, this toxic cesspool, has to be stored and maintained. And who's going to pay for that, and who's going to clean it up after there is no economic incentive for the mine to do the right thing? It's not going to be the mining company who will probably go bankrupt or take another form. It will be the people that live there, just like it's always been. And these happen to be people of color, indigenous folks that have gotten the short end of the stick time and again. And that's what this company is asking these people to accept, taking that risk that something terrible can happen and they're going to have a legacy that is toxic for their children versus a regenerative, sustainable fishery that can go on forever if we just leave it be.
And I would say that your film, The Wild, is a way to get people motivated. It's quite powerful and beautiful. So thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you so much, Evan. It's a pleasure.
That was Mark Titus. His documentary is The Wild. In a minute, if you're like me and tend to retreat to the kitchen in the face of anxiety, I've got a new cookbook recommendation that I think will bring you some comfort. That's next, right here on Good Food. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Watching The Great British Bake Off is like taking anti-anxiety meds for me. I've rewatched a few of the seasons multiple times. One of my favorite contestants is Chetna Khan, who was known during the 2014 season for adding flavors of India, where she's from, to her bakes. But Chetna's gone on to write several cookbooks, many of them savory. Her latest is Chetna's Healthy Indian, Vegetarian. Hi, it's so great to have you here.
Hello, and my honor to be speaking to you.
I wanted to really start off by showing the way you approach the subject, because it seems that, yes, you're obviously cooking food that comes from your background, but you're also personalizing it. So let's talk about your aubergine raita.
So basically, especially for this book, I wanted to obviously share my experiences, my cooking, my recipes. But I had done a lot of that in Healthy Indian, Chetna's Healthy Indian, the first part. So for this book, I actually went back to India. And I went and I kind of tried to look for women who cook for their families, but at the same time work full time, you know, in an office 9 to 5 or whatever. So they come back home and cook really nice, healthy meals. And that's when I actually met a lady who kind of did something on these lines of aubergine raita. And I completely fell in love with it. So that's how it all came about, actually.
Could you explain what raita is for people who have never had it?
So raita is basically a yogurt side dish. In India, you would just serve it with a salt and cumin powder are two kind of key spices to go in a raita. And then comes whatever you want to add. So quite often, everyday cooking, people would just grate a cucumber in it or put bundi, which is fried gram flour balls in it. Or they would just put some onions and tomatoes in it. So it's kind of everyone just puts whatever they have at home, or they would just put salt and cumin powder, and that's called a raita basically. So it's a side dish which goes beautifully with the whole Indian meal. So it kind of cools you down and it just kind of really balances the flavors, I guess.
So describe how you make the aubergine raita. How do you cook the eggplant?
So basically you take an eggplant, aubergine, yes, and then you just make it into small pieces, and then you put some nice salt and pepper and a little drizzle of oil, and then you spread it on a sheet and roast it. What we're trying to do is cook the aubergine, soften it up. Now, if I was sometimes making it for a feast, I would actually deep fry it, because fried aubergine tastes absolutely amazing. But because I am doing a healthier version, I baked it for, you know, half an hour or so until you get a really nice golden outing on it and it goes really soft. And then you get your yogurt prepped. So you add your yogurt and a bit of salt. And not every dish has got sugar in it, but a lot of people I have found add literally a pinch of sugar to balance it all out. And they seem to think that just adding that pinch of sugar brings out the flavors even more. And that's it, really. So you've got your yogurt ready, you've got your eggplant ready, and then you just get a little tempering set up. So tempering is what we call tadka in India. And it's got all sorts of forms and shapes. But in this, you just add some oil and you put some panchpuran. Now, panchpuran translates to five spices, which is a kind of a spice blend that comes from the east of India. And then you add some curry leaves, chilies, and then pour that tempering over the raita. And then it just soaks up all the flavors of the curry leaves and chilies. And it's absolutely divine.
I'm definitely, my little container eggplant is fruiting right now. So I'm definitely making this soon. Another recipe that I thought would be perfect, especially this time of year when tomatoes are starting to come in abundance and in their beautiful seasonal flavor, the tomato and coconut milk soup.
Yes. So what you do is you get your tomatoes and you put a little slit at the bottom of the tomatoes, put them in boiling water. Just basically we're doing this so that we can peel and discard the skin, because we don't want the skin in the soup. And now we're going to put the tomatoes. We're going to cook it with some carrots, some onions, a bit of garlic and some cumin seeds. And then we bring it to a boil and then basically let it cook slowly and let it, simmer for 30 minutes or so, half an hour. We want all the veg you've just added in there to soften up nicely. And then we leave it to cool slightly before we kind of, blitz it and make it into a soup. And that's when we add our coconut milk and some of the spices. So it goes in salt, a bit of ground cumin. I've used dark muscovado sugar here because it's just really nice, deep flavor. And then you bring it to a boil. And once again, we get to the tadka, which is the tempering, because that is going to take this to the next level. So for the tadka, we have some oil in a pan. We add some black mustard seeds. So in India, we use a lot of black mustard seeds rather than the yellow ones, because it's got a slightly different flavor. Obviously, you can use yellow if you have yellow, but we tend to use a lot of black mustard seeds. And then we have add the dried red chilies and curry leaves, and then we let it sizzle for a few seconds. It literally takes a few seconds, because more than a few seconds, you've burned the whole thing. And then you very gently pour it over the soup, and then that's it. And you serve it with just some yogurt if you like. If you don't want yogurt, you don't have to have yogurt. And that's it. And the good thing about most of these recipes is that whatever is left, you can put it in a nice airtight box, you can put it in the fridge, and then you eat it, warm it up and eat it in the week. So that's quite helpful, actually.
Thank you so much, Chetna, for coming to us and sharing these recipes that are just lovely. For people who shop from the farmers market, this is a really wonderful resource.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
That was Chetna Makan. Her book is Chetna's Healthy Indian Vegetarian. Speaking of people who shop the farmers market, Jillian Ferguson is at the market now talking to chefs and farmers about what's in peak season this week in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I cannot believe it's August and we haven't talked about peaches yet this season. But here to remedy that is Hannah Ziskin. Hannah is the pastry chef at M. Georgina in downtown Los Angeles. And during the pandemic, she's also launched a side business called House of Gluten, where she offers cakes, bread, cookies, and pie. Hi, Hannah.
Hi.
So one of the offerings at House of Gluten is a weekly farmers market-inspired pie, and it's sourced almost entirely from the market, from the flour to the fruit. Tell us about this week's pie.
So I like to be kind of mysterious about the pie. I'll say stone fruit, like farmer's market stone fruit pie, and then I come to the market and truly whatever is inspiring me on, like at the Wednesday market, that's what goes into the pie. This week's pie is going to be peaches. They're beautiful right now. They get better and better as the summer goes, as far as I'm concerned. Like the August ones are the very best, so I'm really looking forward to that. I love to do a combination of berries and stone fruit, blackberry, peach. Basically looking at a pie like a plated dessert in a way, where I'm trying to make these flavors like work together and really pop in the pie, not too sweet, not too tart. And yeah, blackberries, peach this week.
Is there a particular variety of peach that you're looking for?
I've been really happy with, I actually don't even know the name of these peaches, but they all have like funky names. It's like August Flame, like mysterious mistress of fall. The Rieger peaches, I'm not sure what the variety is, but I've been really, really happy with them. And they have this perfect balance of sweetness and acidity. I don't peel the peaches. I love peach skin. Rinse off the fuzz a little bit and just use them whole. They're perfect.
So with all pies, but particularly I find this time of year and when you're dealing with market fruit, you really have to taste your fruit before you add your sweetener, your thickener. Tell us about your approach to balancing the pie before it goes in the shell.
I think in baking a lot, people tend to have a recipe and kind of blindly follow it. And I treat baking more like cooking in the sense that I taste everything and I adjust salt and I adjust acidity. There's no recipe and it's deeply dictated by how the fruit tastes. And I think a pie is a really good starting off point in a way for baking where you're not bound by a recipe. Like I use tapioca starch as the one thing that's generally consistent. I choose tapioca starch because it has a cleaner appearance. So when the fruit gels, it has this like beautiful opalescent sheen to it, as opposed to cornstarch, which kind of can look a little cloudy sometimes, muddled, sometimes retains a little bit of like texture. So that's the only thing that I keep consistent. Otherwise, whatever I pick up at the market, I'm tasting the fruit. I'm tasting the fruit pairing, a blackberry, a piece of peach. And then I choose sugars. Sometimes I'll use coconut sugar, brown sugar, white sugar, depending on what flavor aspect I want to emphasize of those fruits. We have a Meyer lemon tree in our backyard, so I've been using Meyer lemon juice to bring out the acidity. Please don't forget to put salt in your pie. That's maybe my most important tip.
So what's the top of your pie like? Is it a lattice? Is it a crumble?
I use a crumble, and I do use 100% Sonora flour in the crumble. It's oats, brown butter, lots of salt. And yeah, I prefer a streusel top pie. I'm a recent convert. I never had done that before until like a year ago. I was like, oh, I got to do like the funky lattice that's like really beautiful, but the crumble just speaks to me.
Great. Well, Hannah, thank you so much. This sounds delicious.
Thank you.
That was Hannah Ziskin. She is both the pastry chef at M. Georgina and the proprietor and baker at House of Gluten. where she sells a weekly farmer's market-inspired pie. You can find her on Instagram at Hannah Ziskin. That's Z-I-S-K-I-N. John Tenorelli is one of several beloved stone fruit growers at Southern California markets, and he's particularly known for his peaches, which show up in June and stay at the market until October. And John, I just learned this week that you actually went to high school with Evan Kleiman. So I am so curious how a high schooler in Silver Lake ends up as a peach farmer in Little Rock, California.
Okay, well, actually, I grew up in Silver Lake. My father was a butcher, had businesses and everything. Back in Italy, he had an uncle that was an agriculture professor, and they lived on orchards and stuff. It was his lifetime passion. So in his retirement, he planted 10 acres of peaches in the early 70s, you know, the Albertas and the Riosos and all these old varieties. When it came time to harvest, the farmer's market started. So my dad recruited me from L.A. He says, you want to do this? And I didn't like what I was doing at the time. And I said, yeah, I'll try it. So I started going to these markets, and they kept opening up new ones. It was like two markets. Then there was three markets. And now there's, you know, whatever. And I kept, so 7 days a week, I was going to markets. And I was a peach-selling maniac. I'm at his age where he started just about.
Wow, wow. So it's in the high desert where you're growing. What advantage does that give you as a peach farmer?
Well, first of all, we're about 3,000 foot elevation, so we have cooler nights than other regions where they grow 99% of the stone fruit. So the fruit allows to stay on the vine a little bit longer, and our flavors are always said to be a little bit more extra better than, you know, the majority of the peach growers. And then they ripen late. And it's a dry, really dry climate, so we don't have to use any sprays or anything for molds or anything. We just don't get that out in the desert.
And one of the great joys for us as shoppers is coming to the market. The varieties change almost every single week. How many varieties are you growing on the farm right now?
Well, when you add up all the plums and everything, it's probably 80 varieties. But peaches alone is probably 25 varieties. Yeah. Nectarines is another 20 varieties. Every 2 weeks it seems to change, you know, because you can pick one variety for about 12 days. Pick it once, 4 days later you pick it again, 4 days later you pick it again. So we have this continuous flow of fresh peaches.
So we're a week into August now. What varieties do we have here on the table, and what's coming down the pike?
You know, we're gonna be finishing up probably the Z Lady peach right now, and we'll be starting to pick the Sangre de Toro, which is like one of our best peaches. We named it the Sangre de Toro. The real name is called Summer Lady. But we named it because the juice is like blood red inside. And, you know, one of the workers said to me, in fact, that guy right there, Severino, he said, that's blood of the bull. So we named it that, and all the customers know it, and they all wait for it. And it's just that this time of year in August is when we really shine. We got Sangre de Toro, we got O Henry, I mean, Alberta, we got the prime of the peach season for us.
Well, thank you so much, John.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, Jillian.
That was John Tenorelli of Tenorelli Orchards in Little Rock, California. He goes to about 20 markets in Southern California. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Coming up, can you imagine keeping a sourdough starter alive for 100 years? It's the story of Diamond Bakery, next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. When I heard that Diamond Bakery on Fairfax was in trouble, I actually teared up. It's an LA institution that's been around for 74 years. 74 years. But its longevity is just part of the story. Raymond Luna is the current president of Diamond Bakery, and he and his fellow worker owners are fighting to keep the bakery alive. Hi, Raymond.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Could you share with us a bit of the history of the bakery? It opened in 1946, so right after World War II. Who started it?
That's correct. You know, I'm going to be honest. I don't have the name of the original owner, but yes, it did start in 1946. It used to be a bakery and a deli right next to it. And this was back when, you know, the Jewish diaspora in the 30s comes to Boyle Heights. And then in the late 30s, they moved from Boyle Heights all the way to what's now the Fairfax District, becoming a de facto Jewish center of culture. So 1946, you have Diamond Bakery opening up and deli. And in the, I want to say 1972, what we now know as the owners, the Rubenstein family, took over that. And it was kind of like a family legacy since the 70s, all the way up until last year. Steven Rubenstein, the previous owner of Diamond Bakery, decided to retire, and he sold us the bakery, his employees.
So this is pretty extraordinary. Tell me when you first came to work at Diamond.
I started working at Diamond because my dad's been working at Diamond since the 90s. He's been working at Diamond for close to 30 years. So when I was a teenager, I would go to the bakery at 4 a.m. and help him out, you know, just to help out, ease up some of the stuff he had on his plate.
So this idea of the employees being able to buy the business where they have worked for a really long time is all too rare. When you were given the opportunity, did you all immediately jump? And who was involved in the group? Everyone or just some of the employees?
Yeah, so it's the now owners are some of the employees, including myself. And we didn't really jump at the idea. It was something that took a lot of thought to decide, because Steven says, I want to retire, you know. And we kind of were sad at first because all of our recipes are a legacy. Everyone knows our corn rye. Our corn rye, no one makes it like us. Our cheesecake, our bagels, all of our recipes haven't changed since the 40s. They're the exact same recipes. And to see all of that go and all that history would be really sad. So, you know, we really thought about it. We gathered some capital and decided to buy out Steven. And he was okay with that because our bread 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago has always been baked by Latinos. Always. That's never changed. Maybe we've had one or two Jewish bakers in the past, in the 80s, in the 70s, but it's always been Hispanic workers, and that hasn't changed. And our recipes have not changed because we recognize and appreciate the history and the culture of the rye, of all of the baked goods that we make every day. And we want to preserve that legacy. And that's why we haven't, now that we've taken over the bakery in the past year, we haven't changed any of the recipes, and we haven't changed any of the workers.
Give us an idea of what we may find in the bakery case on an average day. How many different items do you produce?
You know, we produce our entire lineup every day. And what you see every day is all of the Jewish classics, like the corn rye and the seeded rye, the pumpernickel rye. And of course, all of the classic pastries. So we have cookies called rugelach. And it's a cream cheese based dough type of cookie. It's absolutely delicious, crunchy. And all of our fruit fillings are made from scratch in-house every day. That's why they taste so good. We have a hamantaschen, which is a shortbread type of pastry, a Jewish pastry. We have chocolate chip danishes. We have babkas, if you're from New York, you might be familiar with. Again, a lot of these recipes all originate from New York, more or less.
And you have really amazing challah. I know that when I had my...
Of course, I gotta forget.
Yeah, when I had my restaurant on Melrose, we bought that challah, like 10 loaves every couple of weeks for our bread pudding.
Oh, it's amazing. Amazing for bread pudding and French toast.
And we should say that yours is a bakery that doesn't just rely on foot traffic, but it relies on a lot of wholesale orders.
That is correct. So Diamond Bakery is a wholesale bakery in disguise. You know, more than half, close to 80% of our business is business to business. It's the type of business where we're selling to other restaurants, other delis. I remember a couple years ago, the LA Times ran an article on the top 10 best Reuben sandwiches in LA. And out of those top 10, I think we delivered to about 6 of the top 10 delis in Los Angeles.
That's fabulous.
It's quite the feat, but it's also, you know, we kept it a little secret. Not many people recognize Diamond Bakery. You could recognize the amazing pastrami sandwiches, Reuben sandwiches, but not really recognize Diamond Bakery.
Which is like the foundation of the sandwich.
Of course, of course. If it's not on rye, it's not a Reuben.
So tell me, Raymond, are you still baking?
If I have the time, yes. Before I actually started working at Diamond Bakery, I used to love, and I still do, love baking myself, you know, pastries of all kinds.
What's your favorite thing to make that you just love doing? It's like a meditation for you now.
Sourdough. It's sourdough's meditation for me. I think sourdough is a long process. It's not very involved in the sense that I'm kneading the dough for hours on end, but you do have to give it a couple turns every couple hours. You do have to make sure it's the starter is well fed every single day. It's like a pet.
Are you making anything with sourdough at the bakery?
The rye at our bakery is a sourdough rye. It's made from a starter that we've kept for over 100 years.
That is extraordinary. Nobody knows that.
Yeah, and it's something that I don't want it to be a secret. I want people to know that our starter is very, very old, and we feed it every single day.
I love that you said it's like a pet.
It is. You have to take care of it every single day. No neglect.
So right now, I would imagine things are pretty much of a struggle. Who are you seeing sustaining you now? Is it mostly regulars?
So right now, we're heavily relying on our regulars, our retail side, to kind of support us. We are trying to get the word out that anything, any contribution helps. You know, just coming in for a cup of coffee or coming in for just a Danish helps a lot.
That's Raymond Luna, the president of Diamond Bakery. We've been talking about the effects of the pandemic on business and efforts to keep the doors open. To support Diamond Bakery, visit their GoFundMe page. We'll have a link at our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Kat Yore, Paul Smith, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. I encourage you to watch Mark Titus's film The Wild this week and revel in the magic of one of our last wild places. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.